You see, this is my life. It always will be. There's nothing else. Just us. And the cameras. And those wonderful people out there in the dark. All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Welcome, listeners, to a new and fresh episode of Ready for Close-Up. Unbelievably, 8 months later, I'm joined here by Andy again. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Sam.
It's been an amazingly long break, and I think an amazing amount of stuff has happened, but I'm very happy to be back.
Yes, so am I. I mean, I hope all the listeners who were impatiently waiting for a new episode haven't lost all hope. We're back. Better than ever before, of course, and ready to discuss all things movies, I'd say.
Exactly. So please don't push the unsubscribe button now, but rather stay with us. We thought we'd give you a wrap-up of what has happened, and we figured 8 months is maybe a bit of a big order to fill, so we figured we'd talk about the two main things that I think have been happening. One expected and one rather unexpected. Expectedly, there was a blockbuster summer, I think one that deserved its name, with at least 4 or 5 big movies coming out, and we want to discuss at least 4 of them in this episode. And secondly, of course, Hollywood, after a blockbuster summer, has come to a standstill due to a double strike. We also want to discuss the writers and actors strike and see what that means for Hollywood and future productions. So let's see, blockbuster summer, besides everything else happening, Andy, have you had a chance to see either, of course, the two movies most talked about called Barbenheimer in combination, or have you seen possibly any other of the blockbusters coming out? And can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Yes, of course. I mean, I think, of course, I've seen Barbenheimer. I've seen Barbie. I've seen Oppenheimer. I think the two movies that really generated and were spearheading this blockbuster summer, so to speak. I think there was a huge marketing machinery behind this, and I think the internet went wild for months with all the memes and all the hype building around these two movies, which are very, very different, I think. And this combination of these two movies really, I think, brought the masses in. I think it was a super nice experience both times to be in packed cinemas again. I think this has been really something I haven't experienced, I don't know, 15 years ago with Avatar, maybe the last time, I don't know. I think it's really, yeah, it was nice to be part of a pop cultural wave this summer where really everyone was talking about these two movies. And I've seen some other ones that were maybe not as successful as they probably should have been. But we will talk about those a bit later. I think maybe I would just start with Oppenheimer.
Sure. It's one that I haven't seen yet, actually. I have only seen one half of the Barbenheimer extravaganza and haven't seen it yet. So you have to tell me, is it worth going to the cinema to catch up with the second half of the duo?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think we even had, I think a few years back, we had a whole episode on Tenet and Christopher Nolan's cinema. And I think Oppenheimer is a continuation of that, of his style, of his work, of his mastery, I would say, in cinematic storytelling. And you can really tell that he thinks and creates movies for a big screen. Also the way it's filmed. I mean, I haven't seen it on IMAX, unfortunately, but the movie is filmed in an IMAX format. So it's really, it has a prowess to it, a power that is very undeniably Nolan, and I think it's a great movie. I mean, I was a bit, I don't want to say skeptical, but I was probably less excited to see Oppenheimer than Barbie. now I said it. just also because I was a bit apprehensive towards a 3-hour biopic around the, not the inventor, but like one of the fathers of the atomic bomb. And I wasn't really sure, okay, will this just be men talking about bombs? And in a way it is that. It is 3 hours of men in suits talking about how to build a bomb. And then there is an aftermath after the bomb went off. So it is a bit, I think, a Mad Men done by Nolan in a way. So there's lots of talking, lots of court sessions, lots of interrogations, interviews. But what really makes this movie interesting is really the way Nolan orchestrates everything and makes everything very rhythmic. It's very, it has a drive to it that I found very enticing and fascinating. And I was never bored, which surprised me, to be honest, because there's really this drive in the scenes, in the acting, in the way the music also contributes. And the actors are great. I mean, I think Cillian Murphy is really a standout, and I'm not leaning myself too far out the window when I say he will be for sure a candidate once the Oscar nominations come out later in a few months, because it's really a performance that is very holding everything together. And it's really captivating, even though he's not, you know, they're not really overacting or like super powerful scenes, but it's just really these close-ups on his face that really tell a lot about the trials and tribulations that character went through, the thought process, the doubt, but also the pride. And I think it's really a complex role, and he really masters that beautifully. And he's really surrounded by a stunning cast. I think in every, even the smallest tiny roles are prominent faces. Emily Blunt plays his wife, Florence Pugh, his love interest. Then there is Matt Damon, there's Rami Malek in a small role, Casey Affleck in a small role, Josh Hartnett, Benny Safdie. So there's really a cast. And of course, I don't want to forget Robert Downey Jr., who really plays a bit the Salieri to the Oppenheimer Mozart. So I think there's also a nice dynamic there, a bit as an opponent to Oppenheimer. And yeah, the acting is great, and it really carries the topic, the themes, the movies, and makes it really a delight to watch, even though maybe some things could have been cut, maybe some things could have been a bit more critical, maybe, I mean, I wouldn't say it was the perfect movie or the best movie, because I think for that, and that's a bit something I find is typically Nolan, it's not as emotionally picking me up as other movies do. I think it's really more this technical aspect and the prowess of it all. But there's always something that keeps him a bit at bay. And I think it wasn't different here with Oppenheimer. There's always a bit a fascination and admiration. But is this a movie I would rewatch time and time again? Maybe not. Maybe not. But I enjoyed watching it. It's a great movie. And if you haven't seen it, Sam, really definitely go and see it on the big screen. That's my verdict, yeah.
You know, there were a couple of reasons why I was hesitant to watch it. I also originally wanted to see it kind of back to back. The whole hype had got me too, but then I decided to first see Barbie, and then never really got around to it. I heard very mixed reviews. I read mixed reviews, obviously also in connection with the whole discussion around the release in Japan. Is the film critical enough? I read some mixed reviews by people who had seen the movies back to back and felt it was overrated. I think there were just a couple of things that held me back. But I'm curious about one thing. You know, remembering our Nolan episode, we said that he always works so well with different senses of time, different layers. How is the Nolan touch, you mentioned at the beginning, how is the Nolan touch realized in that movie? How do you feel? Does it feel very typical in that sense, how the movie is structured and built up, or does it stand out for that reason?
Probably it's less how can I say? I think probably it's less this typical Nolan touch in the sense that he really twists around time. But there's still some elements, some scenes where you see two characters, but you don't really hear what they're discussing. And you somehow know, okay, I guess 3 hours down the line, we will know what they spoke to each other. And that happens then. So at the end of the movie, he closes again with scenes. And probably it's a bit more straightforward in terms of linear storytelling. So it's really, the beginning is a bit more biographical, that really how came Oppenheimer to be chosen for this project, this Manhattan Project, where the United States of America wanted to build the atomic bomb before the Nazis did. And it's a bit more his career development. And I think that's told maybe a bit more conventional, as you might think. But what I said in the beginning as well is there is this cadence to it, this drive that really, the tempo that accelerates over time and really makes you feel as an audience also, okay, there is an urgency to everything they do. And I think that's also the way he orchestrates the movie. But there are incidences, I mean, you have these flashbacks, these moments, where he plays with that a bit. And I think there is really clearly his Nolan handwriting, but it's probably not as convoluted, is maybe a negative word, but it's not as over orchestrated as other movies of his. For example, I think Tenet, he went a bit too far in trying to really come up with something super extraordinary and super mind fucky in a way. Or also Dunkirk, who's really like coming down with time. I think this is really the biggest example of how he plays with time. I think Oppenheimer is less of that, but still you have this temporal, how can I say this? This temporal urgency to everything. And I think that way it makes it a very Nolan-esque movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm certainly a big admirer of his techniques, of his style, of the overwhelming nature of his film. So I'm very curious to see that one too. Something that I always notice about Nolan is that I'm not very emotionally involved. And I do believe, like you said before, that is one of the issues why I'm not running for the next Nolan. I know I'll admire it, and know I'll be fascinated by it, but it's not going to take me in and completely blow me away in terms of the emotional investment. But I think this summer also had a couple of movies that were maybe a little bit stronger on that side. But we'll see. Probably makes sense to talk about the other half of that duo, right? Before going into any other blockbuster movies,
we've absolutely
both seen.
Let's get the Barbenheimer. Yes.
The Barb out of Barbenheimer. And from what I could tell from what you said, you were extremely excited to see it. So was I. I had a chance of seeing it in LA this summer, actually, with a bunch of LA people who, were, of course, came all dressed up and cheered throughout the movie. It was a very, very fun experience to be in a cinema that was full of people who were ready to have a party inside the film. And to really take this opportunity. And I think the hype had already been there for such a long time. There had been excellent reviews over and over again for the movie. And I think going into it, I was a little bit hesitant as well, because once you have such good press, of course, the movie has to deliver. And deliver it did, I thought. I think from beginning to end, this was mainly, I think, very well written. And I think that's the backbone of any good comedy. I think we talked about Bros recently as another example of a comedy that is mostly well written, but Barbie really felt like the writing that had been done properly. It had a good basic concept, Barbie world versus the real world. It had excellent satire from beginning to end. It had important themes that were discussed and gone through. It had a cast of thousands, I think, of excellent characters, side characters. And I think it was having fun. I think that was the biggest part. And now all these discussions around, you know, the political wokeism of Barbie, or the representation of men and women in the film and the relationship, I didn't care so much for that. I mean, it was important that it made important statements about the role of girls and women in the world, and how Barbie is supposed to be a progressive doll, but then comes face to face with the patriarchy and the men ruled world, both in Barbie world and the real world. And I think it was, it besides everything else, it was just extremely well written and funny. I laughed a lot, and I think everybody was just enjoying themselves. So definitely happy with that one. How did you feel about Barbie? Same excitement, or were you let down by your expectations?
I wasn't let down, because to be frank, I didn't had any expectations. Because it was really, yes, there was this huge marketing train going on for, I don't know, months. But I couldn't really grasp what this movie will be. And I mean, I was very aware that it's Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach who wrote it. And they're more indie darlings, I would say, especially her as well. So I was really curious what this would be. This, on one side, you have this up-and-coming indie movie maker, and on the other hand, you have this super commercialized toy IP that is like driven from a huge movie studio, and it's really about the big bucks and how these two would blend together. I was really curious how that could work, and I didn't really know what would expect me there in this movie. And I was, as you said, super pleasantly surprised, because the movie is cleverly written. It is a lot of fun. I really enjoyed Margot Robbie in the role. I think she really carries that film. She's really the perfect casting. And everyone is in on this joke, which I also, there's really a joy in that movie. Of course, Ryan Gosling is amazing. As Ken, who's a bit like, yeah, there, but not really needed. And I think it worked on so many levels. It worked as a satire, it worked as a meta comment, it also works with the nostalgia, I think, that the generation now, the millennial generation basically has. So everything was very 1990s Barbie, so I think also the time when Greta Gerwig was a kid. So I think it plays also on that really much. So there are many components who really come together, and it's a very entertaining film. And every time you think you know where it's going, it goes another direction. I also enjoyed that, because you're like, oh no, Barbie's going to the real world, and then it's this fish out of water movie and this ha 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 comedy around that. But then quite quickly it turns into something much more absurd also, and at times really bizarre, and you're just sitting there and like, what exactly is happening? And also the whole scenes in the Mattel headquarters with Will Ferrell. And I think there are really a lot of absurdist scenes in there, which I found quite refreshing, that such a big blockbuster still has this weird, nerdy, a bit geeky touch that is very much Greta Gerwig. And I really love that. So for me, it was really a perfect combination of an intellectual or intelligent, I should say, approach to a very broad topic. And I think it was done very well, yeah.
And also combined with just such a, I don't even know if it's like a clever marketing campaign, I guess it was just perfect timing, because with the Barbie movie, I remember seeing the first announcement and maybe the first teaser trailer, and I thought, what the heck is that? Is it just going to be this colorful, mostly pink, fluffy, light comedy? But then I figured, well, the cast is almost too good to just be a stupid little comedy about Barbie, and then learning who's behind it, and then Mattel was licensing everything, that didn't sound good. But then I think that helped the film then coming from these low expectations to having then these excellent, I think, preview comments that people gave, saying that it's, you know, one of the best films they've seen this year, definitely, or even more. And then just coming to the moment where you actually see the movie, plus the movie then delivering. I think that's a very rare instance where the quality actually lives up to the expectations. And I think very, very often, including some films that we might talk a bit about later, expectations are so hyped that then the movie just can't deliver that much. And I feel with Barbie, it was just good. It was just excellent. It didn't have to. All the reviews were true. And I thought it was interesting how so many different reviewers and audience members had so many connections to it. We were a group of, I would say, two guys my age, and a woman in her mid-50s and a 15-year-old in our group. And they all enjoyed the film for individual reasons and were really talking about the movie afterwards. So it also, I think, instigated conversations between people of very different backgrounds, because the movie attracts such a mixed audience, I think. And many people also went to see it because of the recommendations, and I think mouth-to-mouth propaganda has really worked for that film as well, making it such a successful box office result.
Absolutely. I think everyone wanted also be part of a conversation, part of the conversation. You had to have seen Barbie. And I guess if we're talking about Barbenheimer now, I think Barbie is definitely the more accessible movie also, given its runtime and that it's more a light comedy, and the other one is a more somber political biopic in a way that is maybe not speaking to everyone. And as you said, I think the connection, everyone has some sort of connection to Barbie, or even if you're maybe, in my case, you had like an older sister and you're like, you know what it's like to play with Barbie also. And I think that's also why it resonated with so many people, that there is a nostalgic element to it, that it's also discussed very ironically and on a very nice meta level. So that, like, Barbie, she's not walking downstairs, she's just floating down the Barbie dream house, because that's how you play with the doll, you know, never really walk down with your Barbie doll, you just float it. And I think there's so many things in there that really work, and it's really also taking the topic seriously but at the same time deconstructing it. And what I think also why it was such a success, because it's also something fresh, something new, something done with love and passion. And I think that's really translating into the success now, because it's not the fifth superhero movie, or I don't know, I mean, we talk about later about all these sequels and prequels and
absolutely.
So Oppenheimer is original material in that sense. So I think people are also really hungry for that, and I think that should be the message to movie makers and studios in the future, to trust also creative writers and creative movie makers, and success will give them prove them right. So yeah.
But let's talk about the other side of that blockbuster summer, because as you said, there were these highly original movies that were wildly successful, much talked about, but there was also at least two of our most anticipated sequels of the year, one coming out a little earlier than the other, Indiana Jones Part 5, The Dial of Destiny, and then also, of course, Mission Impossible, which is the first part of Dead Reckoning, a two-part sequel that will conclude next year. Well, we'll see about that. But let's talk about those as well, because obviously with both Indy and Mission Impossible, there have been highly successful installments in each series, but also questionable sequels, where I think both of us would say there were a couple of favorites, but also a couple of letdowns. So starting with Indy, how did that fit into your Indiana Jones universe? I know we're both big fans, especially of the 1980s trilogy. So were you let down by the sequel? Were you lifted up? How did that land with you.
Yes. Thank you for the disclaimer that we're big fans, because we are. And I think with that comes also a certain level of expectations, even though I would say with this one, my expectations were fairly low. I think, and maybe this also explains the misfortune or the flop that the Indy 5 was in the end, that somehow the cultural momentum was not really with Indy anymore, and it isn't. And I think it was wildly successful in the 80s, and then I think it continued to be popular in the pop cultural mindset. And then I think with the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull in the early 2000s, it somehow, there was again a much bigger hype than I think it was now for the fifth part. So there was like this, oh my God, Indy's coming back. And I mean, of course, Harrison Ford was 15 years younger and all that. But I think there with the Crystal Skull, which I didn't find that good as an Indy adventure, it really somehow tempered everything. And I think also there was too much time now in between the Crystal Skull movie and this one, Dial of Destiny, that somehow there was never really again a moment of, oh yeah, Indy's back and we're all excited to go and see it. At least that was the case for me. So I think they couldn't really build up on that. I think also, I'm very sorry to say, but Harrison Ford is also too old. I think they were also sticking with Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones. I don't know if there were plans to like recast him or go, you know, something into a James Bond route or not. But with the decision of really giving him this swan song, they somehow buried the franchise before it really reignited again, if that makes sense. So I think there was never really that much excitement because, yeah, Indiana Jones, it's all about adventure and finding, chasing after MacGuffins and reading treasure maps and punching some Nazis and jumping on a plane and all these things. And in the fifth part, there are these elements, they are there. So I think it feels a bit more harking back to the original trilogy and giving, I don't want to say it's a fan service, but it's like very reminiscent of many elements that made the first three movies so great. So it's really a bit of a best of, okay, you have a train chase, you have Nazis, you have exotic locales in the desert, you have a hidden tomb that is suddenly filling with water. So there are all these elements that are known. You've seen that in other Indiana Jones and in the Mummy franchise and in any other basic archaeological adventure ever already. So it's a bit repetitive in that sense. But I really have to say, and now it's my big but, I was super entertained by all of that. I was really pleasantly surprised how much I enjoyed that movie. And I was a bit disheartened that it was completely trashed by critics. It was completely trashed by audiences. And I had an amazing time in the cinema. It was really the adventure movie that I wanted and I hoped it would be, and it was. And I think there were many things that probably in hindsight don't really work, or they're not really, don't make any sense. But these 2 hours in the cinema, I was entertained. I loved the chemistry between Phoebe Waller-Bridge and him. Harrison Ford is Indy. And they also address his age now, maybe in a way that is more appropriate than it was in Kingdom of Crystal Skull, where it was really a bit more, yeah, negative. And I think here it's more, yeah, also maybe a more nostalgic lens onto the character. So there were things that I really enjoyed, and it's clear you can't turn back time and you can't make an 80-year-old actor still run around and punch Nazis like he did 40 years ago. So of course you somehow accept that, and I think that's also my main critique probably then, that there is not really, you can't repeat that magic again, even if they do all this de-aging in the prologue scene and they try to like really dive into that retro feeling, but it just doesn't really work. So for me, to come conclusion to all this babbling, I really enjoyed it. There were nice elements to it. I was pleasantly surprised, because maybe also my expectations were lower than they should have been. So I don't know how you feel about your indie experience.
Well, very, very similar. I also went in with low expectations after reading bad reviews and disappointed comments so far. So I figured, well, let's see about it. And I think from the beginning, from the Nazi train and the scenes in New York when you meet the old indie and the whole context of that, up until the very end, even the questionable finale, talking of turning back time, you know, you can't turn back time to get the indie of the 80s back, but you can turn back time and send him into antiquity, apparently, by some time loophole. So despite all the strangeness of that plot, I was just having a great time. I think Harrison Ford landed exactly right. He is so old, and he played the old indie perfectly. He had his usual spunk, you know, his sense of humor that was still there. I totally believed he was this grumpy old man who didn't want to go on another adventure, but then the involvement with Phoebe Waller-Bridge and as the daughter of his best friend, played by Toby Jones in the prologue, also, I think, just worked for me. It was just believable that he would go on the adventure. And I think I enjoyed how they made Phoebe Waller-Bridge's driving force of the plot. So, so Harrison Ford didn't have to be sporty indie anymore. And he also didn't have to have Shia LaBeouf on as his quasi-son. And then, yeah, it turns out he is his son. To kind of replace him. I think they didn't do the mistake that they made with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And still, he had a big enough role, big enough shoes to fill. He was active. He was reacting. It was a fun dynamic between the two. I also really enjoyed their globetrotting, the underwater scenes, and then how they go to Sicily, and from then, of course, into that finale I mentioned before, flying over Syracuse and seeing the siege and all that. It was just terribly entertaining, and I think also a type of cinema that I had been missing, the type of old school adventure cinema that, of course, Indiana Jones originally was, even imitating from the 1930s and then kind of bringing it back in the 1980s. And I feel that sense was there. It was nostalgic. It brought in a few new locations, like this the parade in New York and this underwater scene. I think it was just a nice kaleidoscope of scenes as well, which good Indiana Jones movies always were. And I cared for it. I thought it was also given a nice finale with him somehow landing again in New York, and with an open question whether that will be his last adventure. There's a nice coda to his relationship with Marianne, and even a reference to that son, unfortunately brought in the last movie. So I think they also paid reference not just to the old Indiana Jones and what had worked in especially Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Last Crusade, but also just giving it a nice homage as a series. Most likely it will be the last one, at least starring Harrison Ford, and I hope that in a way that it is, not trying to drag more out of that. But I think it was a worthwhile finale. I really came out. I was humming the music and went home to listen to it. And I think it stayed with me for quite a while. I was very, very satisfied by it.
Yeah, absolutely. I can sign all that. Because that's it. I think it was really an entertaining evening at the cinema. And I enjoyed it. I think it's if as you say, if you like that kind of old school adventure cinema, you have these beautiful set pieces and all that. So it really comes together, and it doesn't want to be anything more. It doesn't want to make any comment on anything. So it's really just this straight up adventure and this quest and how it then turns out. And of course, yeah, the time hopping twist in the end. But if you think it somehow also fits into the vein of the Indiana Jones movies, we're always in the end. I mean, Holy Grails and the Ark, who then releases all the spirits, was not very realistic either.
But, and aliens.
Exactly. And the aliens, of course. Oh, this has been forgotten, you know. exactly. So I think it all worked together, and I liked it. Yeah, it was, I enjoyed it a lot.
And I think also just for the music sitting there in the end credits and just hearing the John Williams score, unbelievably, he still wrote another score for that movie, and he's still going strong. But it also made me realize that, of course, in other blockbuster movies, I think including the ones that we've already talked about, maybe with the exception of Barbie, which is a bit of a different case, but there wasn't all that wall-to-wall music, and it was very identifiable and had this sense of, yeah, that's what blockbuster cinema should sound like still. If I'm thinking of the other big sequel, Mission Impossible, I think that was one of its issues, that it literally was a wall-to-wall action experience. And for instance, the music was just very unidentifiable. So you haven't seen Mission Impossible as far as I know.
I haven't seen it yet, unfortunately, no. Actually, it was on my list. I wanted to go and see it, but as of now, I didn't manage to see other things. But happy to hear your thoughts on that, definitely.
Well, I hope I'm not gonna spoil anything, just in case you're going to see it, so I'll keep it to spoiler-free territory. I would definitely recommend it. I saw it twice, actually, and I was a bit more skeptical the first time round because the reviews have been excellent, and I went in with very high expectations. And I think especially Fallout, the previous installment, had been one that I really liked, and I felt it introduced a great set of new characters, and also combine them with the staple characters, particularly Vanessa Kirby also, and her gang of characters that come back in this film. And I think that's a little bit of the letdown, or at least what I felt the first time round, that the film kind of relied on the successes of Fallout. And what it introduces is a kind of a discussion around artificial intelligence, in the form of a computer that takes control of things. That's kind of the main plot line. And that's relatively simplistic, but effective. But it maybe doesn't feel as novel as Fallout did, in the sense of bringing in fresh blood and new dynamic to the Mission Impossible franchise. I still think everything is in place. The action is absolutely spectacular. And of course, everybody has been talking about this motorcycle jump that has been very much advertised and introduced prior to the film. There's excellent chase scenes, especially in Rome, that is a little bit similar to the scenes in Paris in the last one. There is a fantastic train scene as well. I even thought there were some eerie parallels between Indiana Jones and Mission Impossible in terms of the choices of locations and types of action scenes. And of course, visually, Mission Impossible is superior to Indiana Jones. With Indy, you always felt a little bit in those chase scenes that definitely there's a lot of back projection and there's a lot of trickery involved. With Mission Impossible, everything is very crisp, very authentic. You know that this train has actually been used to run on, to jump on. The motorcycle jump is all real. The cameras are really in the cars in that chase scene in Rome. So you really feel it. It's very, very dynamic and exciting to watch. I felt it's a little simplistic on the plot side, which is a strength and a weakness at the same time. Just to say in one sentence, in the end, everything revolves around a two-part key, something you have to put together to make it work. And basically, all the scenes revolve around Tom Cruise and his crew getting one or the other part of the key and delivering it to the right people or the wrong people and so on. That's basically what happens throughout the film. And in another eerie parallel to Indiana Jones, of course, that's the same thing, right? The Dial of Destiny is also exactly that. So
exactly,
it's very memorable. There's definitely not someone who will not understand the plot in this one. But at the same time, they, of course, do the usual confusing, you know, who's good, who's bad. What is the key actually used for in the end? What happens if those people get it or the other people get it? So I think it's a very well played, considering it's such a simple device that they use, or simple MacGuffin that they use in this case. Hayley Bennett is excellent. But it makes sure that Rebecca Ferguson, who had been part of the past two movies, somehow doesn't quite get that exciting part anymore that she had in those earlier films. So I think they're kind of introducing Hayley Bennett because she is supposed to be the new partner of Tom Cruise, I guess also for the second part. And I think that is a bit noticeable. It feels like they introduce Rebecca Ferguson into that movie, but actually have something else in mind at the same time. And it did feel the villains, yeah, were good. Vanessa Kirby's in there again with questionable motives. And there's a cast of evil characters as well. But I would say it feels a little bit, and it is obviously like the first part of something that needs to continue. It's closed in itself, so it doesn't leave a whole lot open. It feels like a complete movie, but at the same time, you can tell that they're saving stuff for the second part. And I'm very excited to see the second part. It's a relatively long first part, but 2.5, close to 3 hours. But it's very entertaining and just worth seeing for the locations, the action, the dynamics, the excitement. So if you get a chance, definitely catch up with it.
Yeah, I definitely will. I think it's also because you know, we're talking about Fallout, and I just try to remember what this movie was about. or because for me, these Mission Impossible movies, they all blend into one big soup at this stage. So I can't really tell them apart, if I'm completely frank. I think I just know that I always enjoy them. And as you said, the action pieces, the action scenes, the setups, they're always impeccably well done. I mean, that's really the unique selling point of these movies, that you get spectacular action that is really still handmade and not just actors in front of a green screen. So I think that's always, for me, a very nice draw into these movies, and that's why they're so enjoyable, because you really... Yeah, you really feel entertained, and you chat around the world, and they're going on these chases and adventures, and I will definitely watch it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also go back to some of the older ones. It made me want to rewatch some of the previous ones, especially the last two or three.
Do you need to have seen the last two, three before that one to make sense, or should do you think I should rewatch them? Or at least Fallout to be up to speed, or can I just go in and...
I have the impression that you shouldn't. It's not that, you know, plot will be hard to understand. I think Mission Impossible plays it nicely and safely. you feel it's kind of for intelligent people, but actually it's not. It works for everybody. And I think that the disadvantage is that I feel Fallout is a slightly better movie. So if you maybe watch Fallout afterwards, be excited by this one, that probably will make you want to watch Fallout again, and maybe Rogue Nation, just to see those characters introduced. But I feel you should just go into it with a fresh mind, because it also, and that's the nice thing about Mission Impossible, they're kind of standalone movies, even though they're part of a franchise. They work a little bit like the James Bond movies used to, at least until the Daniel Craig era, where you don't really have to have seen so many connective things before you can watch the new ones. And it just catches you at the beginning with a great submarine scene, and then you're in the middle of it, and it doesn't really matter whether you know who Rebecca Ferguson is, or Ving Rhames, or Simon Pegg. I mean, these are just like staples that exactly. make sense on their own. But a lot to watch this summer. I was pleasantly surprised to have had so many good blockbusters without even having seen all of them. But maybe we also should mention the fact that at the moment, despite the great turnout at the box office this summer.
Who knows
if who we will have next what we're year. Gonna get.
Exactly.
So Hollywood's on strike, has been on strike for many weeks now. And I also happened to come across the picket line outside Paramount Studios in Hollywood, just going on a studio tour and then just seeing people walking in circles and carrying their shields and their slogans. Mm-hmm. And there's no end to it. I just read that Labor Day will not bring an end to the strike. And some are suggesting that the strike might last into 2024 as well, if nothing changes. Proposals by the studios have been turned down, especially by the writers. There was a discussion around increase in percentage and an increase of the writing room for especially television shows, that the writers were demanding to have more people work on episodes and being able to join productions as well. New writers coming in. So Hollywood is standing still. Writers and actors are on strike. What's your perspective on that? Is it a justified strike? Are they exaggerating? Should they get back to work so we can get our series and releases? What's going on?
Well, to be honest, I haven't really, really delved into the topic as much as I potentially could have. But I think it's important that people get paid for their work. And I think the entertainment landscape has changed tremendously in the past 5 to 10 years, especially with streaming. And I think also the way these writers and also actors are paid is somehow not really reflecting anymore the standards that they are working in the industry now. So I think back in the days, if you were writing for a sitcom like Friends, you would get every time it was aired, you would get some residuals. And now it's not the case anymore, even though streaming and much more content and much more movies and series are available, but people don't get paid the same way they used to. So I think there's definitely, I think, a rightful demand to renegotiate that and rediscuss that. And I think also with the upcoming or with the already there, with the uncertainty around AI and what it means for writing scripts, what it means for having just computer generated extras in the background or whatever, you know, so making people obsolete. I think that's a bit more of a cultural, ethical discussion, but I think it's also a valuable point there that writers and actors demand prospects for their work also in the future to come and not being replaced by machines, as sci-fi that may sound. So I think there's definitely a lot of understanding from my side for these guilds, that they're really demanding fair wages. And I think because it's really concerning the big studios, you know, that are, I guess, through the streaming era, have become very profit driven, and it's all about content and it's all about maximizing profits. And maybe what I hope is that they can find an agreement soon enough. So a lot of works and lives are intertwined. There's a whole industry depending on that. So I hope it picks up very soon, but also with circumstances that are profitable for everyone and not just a few studio bosses, but also the small extra and the small showroom writer, assistant, whatever, you know. So I think to be seen.
To be continued, like, exactly.
Exactly. It doesn't seem like they're finding any solution soon. So that's a shame, yeah.
Yeah, and it's tragic to see those big production venues just close down, and people are just kind of doing little maintenance work, and everything is at a standstill, and you start to realize when you're there how much is produced there, not just films and television shows, but also just TV shows and specials in general. So such a big production, such a city dedicated to that. And if you think that there's Paramount and Netflix and Universal and all the big studios that have their lots there, and if you think of all that's connected to writing and acting in a wider sense, of course, that's tragic to see, but I guess it's an important discussion to have. I think Fran Drescher was very public about in her statements, and very, very strong in her statements about the effects of, as you said, AI, the studios that just seem to profit from investing less and less in writers and actors and still turning out their profit. Series are getting shorter, but they're still turning out new seasons. So people, of course, are mm-hmm. increasingly still watching it. And I think it probably is a good idea to have that noticeable delay in productions now for everybody. I think it's something that will become very apparent as the months go on, as we move into 2024, when there will be, again, after the pandemic years, a lack of stuff coming out. And I think that's an important flag to go up and say, well, if we want good productions, not just cheap ones, done on the cheap, then I think this issue will have to be resolved. And I guess Hollywood is not the only, certainly the most important, the biggest production that area that has to face these questions. But also, yeah, what happens to filmmaking if you can do it so differently, and even without the help of so many staff writers or so many supporting actors who are not making the $20 million per film, but mm-hmm, who are sometimes mm-hmm. getting minimum wage and have to work different jobs to get by. So yeah, very interesting issue to see in terms of what 2023 will look like in the second half. So splendid blockbuster summer followed by a standstill. What will that mean for releases that we can actually discuss?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're still... I think it's a very volatile calendar. If you look at the fall, there are already some movies postponed to next year because the stars will not be able to, most likely not be able to promote the movies. So I think Dune Part 2 is probably the most prominent example of that. So I would just hope they resolve the issue and we can have all the movies coming up. And we can see them also in theater and they can be decently promoted. But still, I think now also with the Venice Film Festival currently in full swing, the fall calendar is shaping up and there are a few movies that are coming out that I am excited about. I think one of them is probably, I mentioned it, it's the... Haunting in Venice, which is Kenneth Branagh's third Agatha Christie adaptation, after we already famously had a whole episode on his last feature, Death on the Nile. This one is starring in Venice, and it features Michelle Yeoh, Kelly Reilly, Tina Fey, Jamie Dornan, so I think a cast of less problematic actors than Death on the Nile had. And it's from a lesser known novel of Agatha Christie, which is called Halloween Party. And yeah, since it's lesser known, I haven't read it. It's the first time they adapted into a movie, and I think they also changed a few things. And from the way the trailer looks, it's veering more into horror goth territory. So I'm very curious about that one also because I'm a sucker for whodunits and Agatha Christie movies in general. So definitely we'll see that one. And then there is the new Martin Scorsese movie coming out in October, Killers of the Flower Moon, which is, it's also a book adaptation actually, and I've read the book a few years back, which is a real life story. It's a real story in the beginning of the 20th century where oil is found on the lands of a Native American tribe, and so bit by bit, the owners of the land, the Native Americans, they are dying due to illness or to strange accidents. And there's also the birth of the FBI linked to these cases, because then there's people investigating on why these Native Americans are killed one by one. So it's really a thriller, but also a political side to that. And it has an amazing cast. Of course, there's Robert De Niro in it, Leo DiCaprio, female lead is Lily Waterstone, and I think Brendan Fraser is also there, fresh after his Whale Oscar win. He will be seen, he can be seen in this movie again, so I'm definitely excited about that one. But do you have any favorites or something you have set your eye on for the upcoming months that you would like to see?
I mean, definitely one that I'm pretty sure is coming out, even though I'm a little bit worried now that you mentioned it, is Ridley Scott's Napoleon, that I've been excited about. And there have been trailers coming out, and it looks extremely good in terms of the visuals, but also I'm excited about Joaquin Phoenix taking up the role of Napoleon in this film. Vanessa Kirby is in it too, and a couple of other lesser known characters, but and interesting faces. So I hope this is going to come out in November as planned. I must say that the other films, looking at the list of things that are not coming out, I mean, there's a whole lot of TV and streaming. I think Emily in Paris, Stranger Things, The White Lotus, all of it is not coming out or is being delayed. Dune, I was looking forward to. Challengers, the new movie by Luca Guadagnino, I was kind of excited about after seeing some trailers. And I think, yeah, that's about it, what I was looking forward to for at least the end of the year. But of course, that is going to take us well into 2024, with even some other things delayed. I'm thinking of Gladiator Part 2. I'm thinking of Spider-Man Part 4 and so on. So also the Marvel Universe will be heavily delayed into 2024 and beyond. So I don't quite know what to say. What I think could be an advantage to it is that maybe we can focus a little bit more on independent movies and non-American movies. I think from a European, from a Swiss perspective, that I think will be an interesting next year. Slots will be maybe available for films that normally wouldn't have made it to cinema. So I'm thinking that might be the upside of that until Hollywood figures it out. But yeah, we'll have to see. It will be definitely, again, an interesting period of film releases.
Definitely. And I think also even now until the end of the year, there are also movies, I mean, they're still lined up. If they then eventually come out or not is another story. But there is a new Yorgos Lanthimos coming out. I think David Fincher has a movie out with Michael Fassbender. So as you say, I think there's a shift towards more independent productions, more auteur-driven productions with lower budgets, lower marketing budgets as well, potentially. But I think maybe that's also not a bad thing. And as you say, these movies then get a brighter spotlight on them because people want to see new things. I think that's not something that's gonna go away. So I'm hopeful. I think we will not wake up one day and there are no movies in the world we can see.
We shall not starve. We shall not starve.
No, we shall not. I think it looks very good. I'm very hopeful for the rest of the year. And I think we will definitely dissect one or the other of these pieces in one of the upcoming episodes.
Well, definitely. I'm very hopeful about that, and I think we can end on that very bright note indeed. So hopefully very interesting releases coming out, and maybe shifting our perspective also away from 80% American Hollywood productions. I think even for American cinema that might be a healthy thing or experience to go through. So let's see how that plays out for our release calendar for the fall and for upcoming episodes. So thanks a lot, Andy, for talking to me again. And
thank
I think
you.
We noticeably had to wrap up on a lot of things and to catch up. And I hope that we will be talking sooner than in half a year's time when we come
definitely
back. So listeners, join us again when we are ready for close up. Bye-bye.
What do I have to do?
You have to go to the real world. You can go back to your regular life, or you can know the truth about the universe. The choice is now yours.
The first one, the high heel.
You have to want to know, okay? Do it again.
Closer I am to fine. Closer I am to fine.
I'm coming with you.